And good morning. Here we are. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Roland. Be with you for the next 55 minutes, and you can talk to me and talk to everybody else who's listening in present time, either by some electronic device or some more old-fashioned radio receiver of FM signals, either 90.7 FM in Portland area or one of the other frequencies out in the gorge or down in the Willamette Valley way. I'd like to hear some of you people in the further reaches as well, but we'd like to just hear from you. We're going to be talking about postmodernism. That song, of course, was Talking Heads, a warning sign. I don't know what the warning sign is or what the things to come are, but you can read into it what you will. So we're going to talk about postmodernism. Why? I don't know. It's my radio show. I get to choose. If you want to suggest topics, feel free to do so. You can get in touch with me through the website, kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. And you click on the host, Paul Roland, and it has a way to email me directly. I've also got this email that I've used off and on. Haven't gotten a lot of traffic recently, but it's paulrkabu@gmail.com. I put it out there that I'm looking for people to participate in various ways in this program. So I'll put that out there again. Get in touch with me. Postmodernism, what is it? Why are we talking about it? Why am I talking about it? Well, I started really thinking about it. I think last year, in the context of these are some really old articles. I'm not sure how I came across them, but discussion of a climate denialism and postmodernism. So, okay, postmodernism has various meanings by now. Sort of generic way of referring to a relativism regarding truth. You know, the skepticism that there's any neutral ground from which you can definitively claim that anything is true or not true, just or unjust. It really started as this claim that there's no more any grand narratives to, like, keys to understand history, such as Marxism. But it has sort of come to mean this sort of general general muddying of the waters, the general idea that there is no way to tell truth from fiction. So, of course, now people are calling Trump the first postmodern president. So anyway, I was looking into this phenomenon of climate denialism because I've talked a lot about climate change here on the program. And if you go down the rabbit hole of the internet and look into some of these Facebook groups, like Climate Change Discussion is one that I've been on and off a couple times, back on again now, where there's just these ridiculous debates and a lot of trolls who it's hard to tell whether they're just cynical, just playing games, whether they're 4chaners, people who sort of engage in this cynical internet gaming, trying to, troll people, trying to, as I said, muddy the waters, who don't really seem to believe in anything in particular. So anyways, a few articles I read is climate denialism, postmodern, but these are all, what's the other one? Once and for All, Climate Denial is Not Postmodern, which are both reactions to an article by Judith Warner in a New York magazine called Fact Free Science. And it says that makes the case that, you know, climate denialism sort of comes out of this general postmodern milieu, and so there's a debate raged. This was back in 2011 around that. And then more recently, I was doing some Google searches. I found a really interesting article called The Anthropocene and the End of Postmodernism, which I will read some from 2015. Another article by, I believe, a Marxist scholar called The Rise and Malaise of Postmodernism, which I highly recommend if you really want to get into this stuff, by Jeremy Smith. And I'll read some of that. It's kind of long, so I won't be able to read much, but I think it lays out some of the basic ideas. And then more recently, from last summer, this article by Jeff Heer in a New Republic called America's First Postmodern President, which also elicited some debate online. And I might read a couple paragraphs from that. Let me just start out. I know I got a caller already, Sean. Let me just start out, if you want to hold on a second here, by reading a few paragraphs from this article, The Rise and Malaise of Postmodernism, because anybody who doesn't really understand it, this might help you to understand it and to see why, at least I think, it's an important thing to consider, especially in these times. I guess 2016 was called the post-truth, was sort of the phrase of the year, the word of the year. And obviously, we see it hasn't really abated the Trump's muddying of fact and fiction, and now every pronouncement he makes is since the Republican establishment based backwards to really defend or clarify or whatever these bizarre pronouncements of our Trumpista in chief here. So, it's a very bizarre situation, and whether or not the idea of postmodernism has anything to do with it or not, I'll leave you to decide. Okay, so here we go. Postmodernism as a cultural and ideological mood arose in the wake of the so-called crisis of Marxism announced in the mid-1970s. It is itself difficult to define, and activists in the social movements and comrades among the organized socialist left commonly ask, what is it, and what are its implications? It is a spectrum of thought that seems to touch many areas of academic and cultural practice, and yet it is willfully elusive. From one position, the origins of the word postmodern can be traced back to Latin American sources in the 1930s, but really it achieved currency much later. In one respect, it is an attempt to come to terms with widespread social, cultural, and economic changes that quickly followed the end of the post-war boom, which most Marxists characterize as the period of late capitalism. In a more ominous way, it is a revival and revision of older philosophical currents that laid out a challenge to the claims by Enlightenment philosophers that humanity was on the path of progress. For Marxists, the vital concern is with the challenge it issued during the 1980s and 1990s to historical materialism and to the viability of the socialist project. More recently, however, the breathtaking rise of the movements against corporate globalism and the war on Iraq have forced an impasse in postmodernist thinking. And of course, now you see how dated this article actually is, which adds a whole other layer to thinking about this article in particular, but we'll leave that aside. Furthermore, the socialist project has reemerged alongside of and within these movements with an alternative vision of a human future that vies with the heirs of postmodernist thinking for the adherence of new activists. And then, of course, you could say, I'm inserting myself here, the Bernie Sanders phenomena sort of, might give new life to this thesis that he's doing. But anyway, this article traces the manner in which the postmodern mood arose, the common beliefs of postmodernist doctrines, and some reasons for their current malaise. It looks also at the legacy of full-blooded postmodernist thinking at the point of its impasse, embodied in a watered-down version in Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's Empire. It addresses only the founding post-structuralist writings of postmodernism and their lasting impact, and in no way professes to capture the full diversity of perspectives that appear under the heading of postmodern. For the purposes of the main argument, a clear distinction is made between the former and the latter. Indeed, some Marxists have theorized developments in late capitalism as postmodernity, while not accepting postmodernist claims about knowledge. While there are grounds to disagree with such views, they can be debated productively because they are articulated within the broad framework of historical materialism. This article also does not attempt to engage debates over how postmodern strategies can be enacted by progressive workers in different white-collar professions, for example, teaching, to expose dominant ideas and support empowering practices for dominated groups. As you can see, this is a rather complex argument here. It should be read more modestly as a guide for socialists and Marxist activists to the problems of postmodernist philosophy and social theory and the kinds of arguments needed to counteract them in the movements. Okay, so this gets into the nitty-gritty here. Postmodernism's rise came at the tail end of the 1960s radicalization, which drew people to Western and Orthodox Marxism. The different schools of Western Marxism had been a meeting point of Marxist and non-Marxist philosophy since George Lucas and Antonio Gramsci. Orthodox Marxism variously continued as a living philosophy and politics in the different non-Stalinist traditions, even while it was rendered a stale state religion under Soviet and Chinese Stalinism. Western Marxism and other non-Stalinist and Trotskyist traditions sustained the critical and radical edge of the Enlightenment in opposition to both Stalinism and the bourgeois social sciences, although the traditions of revolutionary Marxism were clearer and more resolute in this opposition. With the decline of the movements of the 1960s in the West, post-structuralism filled an ideological vacuum with its sharp critique of Enlightenment ideas, as I turn the page, of universal reason and truth. Its influence was evident in general debates on science, knowledge, and political commitment. Moreover, it was read and discussed by many of the students of the 1960s generation. Overall, its rise located Marxism further from the center of the store of human knowledge and coincided with a recession of organized socialist movements in the West. The leading postmodernists began their philosophical trajectories in mid-1960s. But as with this the retreat from the radicalism of that period and the loss of a sense of collective endeavors that postmodernism developed its identity. Postmodernists such as John Baudrillard and ex-Trotskyist Jean-François Lyotard themselves date the 1960s as a turning point in their thinking. Left radicalism reached a high watermark in 1968. The year, and another reason why I'm getting into this, because this is, the 50th anniversary of 1968 and the birth of KBOO Radio. So it all kind of goes together. The year featured the mass revolt in France and subsequent strike waves in Mexico City, Berlin, Spain, Tokyo, where there was a large student movement, Uruguay and Belgrade. Czechs and Slovaks rebelled against Stalinism. The Moro government fell in Italy after student strikes. The Chicago riots at the Democratic Convention were a peak point of U.S. radicalism. General strikes broke out in Senegal and Pakistan. The momentum of the radicalization sustained the worldwide pattern of revolt well into the 1970s. However, after the upsurge, many Western radicals felt disappointed in their hopes for the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. Divested of their aspiration for revolution, many in the 1980s and 90s entered middle age and the new consumption-oriented middle class, forming an audience for postmodern cultural politics. And I'm sure many of you listening might either identify or know people who are identified with that description. Developments in France were at the heart of the rise of postmodern philosophy. The defeat of the May-June movement in 1968 was decisive for the French intelligentsia, who founded post-structuralism. Even though the core ideas of French philosophy provided no real inspiration for the movement's participants, the many radicals who took part in this revolutionary opening challenged the institutions of power. Many interpreted the failure to bring about the total transformation that they aspired to as the failure of the organized Marxist movement. Many identified the Stalinist French Communist Party, which during the crisis paraded as the guardian of bourgeois law and order, as a decisive force that demobilized the revolutionary process. Some, such as Luc Ferry and Alain Renault, construed events as a social democratic modernization of French society that was set off unwittingly by radical student leaders. However, many of the French intelligentsia of the 1968 generation became deeply suspicious of what they saw as common features of Marxism and liberalism, a focus on structures of power, the pursuit of truth, and disciplined forms of political organization. Many others sought a new metaphysics to explain the betrayal of the May movement and its subsequent collapse. This was the beginning of, quote, postmodern times in the estimation of the new post-structuralists. I'll just read one more paragraph here for the time being, because we're already at 8:20. The apparent failure of the movements of the 1960s gave way to a postmodern pessimism about mainstream political thought and strategy. The postmodern mood had an economic and political context in three factors that fueled the climate of disenchantment. One, the end of the post-war industrial boom. Two, the fragmentation of the social sciences and the drift. And three, the drift of Western politics to the right. Rates of industrial growth in the West fell after the 1973 oil crisis, bringing the twin nightmares of inflation and unemployment to the world economy. The pattern of steady growth dissipated, and capital found higher returns in speculative activities. Neoliberalism promoted these developments, and it increasingly became the creed of the bureaucratic cadre of Western states. A new middle class receptive to postmodern thinking coalesced in those segments of Western economies that enjoyed the precarious boom of the 1980s. Multiculturalism and the politics of difference were well suited to the new global mobility of this class. I'll just read another few sentences here. The end of industrial expansion impacted on the social sciences also. There was already an existing sense of internal crisis in social scientific thought and practice. Its functional role of formulating ameliorative reform ended, leaving its advocates and practitioners in a state of uncertainty about their vocation. This is a very fundamental point that I would like to emphasize. You know, the whole Great Society, you know, there really was a lot of people from the 60s generation found their way into the professions, you know, and before, and, you know, felt a real place to, you know, this idea of, you know, there really was the whole, you know, great compromise within capitalism, you know, that kind of arose out of the crisis of the Great Depression, to put it very simply, you know, led to this sort of the welfare state and everything associated with it. And, you know, a lot of social workers, a lot of other people who, you know, found actually a you know, meaningful to them profession, you know, livelihood in, you know, actually practicing the what they learned in the social sciences. And so all that kind of, you know, and then of course, you know, the Reaganism, Bushism, now Trumpism keeps hammering at the last vestiges of that, and the crisis continues. Anyway, let me just finish by saying here, leaving its advocates and practitioners in a state of uncertainty about their vocation. The terrain of the social sciences looked like a new and radical plurality that had left behind the reformism associated with functionalist social scientific research. Perspectives on theory multiplied as the radicals of the 1960s filled the junior ranks of academia, especially in the U.S. The crisis of sociology affected many disciplines in liberal arts and humanities. There was a steady, although uneven, decline in the prescription and analysis of reforms and a greater concern with cultural questions. Okay, and as I said, this is a multi-page article called The Rise and Malaise of Postmodernism by Jeremy Smith. I'm sorry, I neglected to write down where this is from, but I'm sure you can Google it. Okay, so that's my beginning of the discussion. And if Sean is still there, hey, you can join the conversation. Hello, Sean.
Good morning, Paul. Hey, I thought Derek Jensen conclusively demolished postmodernism by bringing up two simple truths. We all need clean air, and we all need clean water. End of debate, right? This postmodernism seems to me a tendency that I've characterized as fatalism, cynicism, and opportunism. Like, I think the end of the draft had a lot to do with the rise of postmodernism. It's very easy to get very philosophically convoluted when you're no longer faced with being shipped into a combat zone.
Well, so, yeah, I think you're missing some. If you read this article by Jeremy Smith, he gives it, actually more credence than you're giving it. I mean, okay. the fundamental point of sort of the critique of, you know, this Enlightenment claims to, you know, to like objective truth, you know, there is something there. It's a difficult one to consider, but the claims of Marxism to sort of universality, the idea of these grand narratives, there is something there. You know, there is really a debate to be had.
Well, if we take the premise that capitalism cannot exist without consumerism, and consumerism is quite literally killing planet Earth and, you know, heading towards making life unsustainable and eliminating clean air and clean water, we're immediately brought back to the fact that we must be anti-capitalist. That must be the basis of all our activity, that the culture of business, the culture of the entrepreneur, the whole ecosphere of capitalism and of entrepreneurialism, that has to be our number one enemy. And anything that interferes with that one focus, keeping our eyes on the prize like that, that is counter-revolutionary garbage and should just be discarded as such. So,
okay. Thank you for calling. And, you know, that is sort of the point of this article that I mentioned, the Anthropocene and the End of Postmodernism, which I will begin to read from. I mean, if I had my S together, I would probably have synthesized all these articles and written my own synthesis. But obviously I didn't do that. So it's a bit of a scattershot thing, but bear with me. And we got James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the climate change, global warming, environmental aspect to this. There is an independent journalist by the name of James Corbett, and he has a documentary out. You can see it on YouTube. It's called Why Big Oil Conquered the World. And it wasn't about necessarily about just the acquisition of oil. It was about control of the people, ownership of the people. And that these oligarchs, as he characterizes them, were behind the eugenics movement of the early 20th century. And now they have repackaged and marketed the eugenics movement under the guise of sustainable development. And what they're doing is getting us to give them permission to starve to death billions of people around the globe through sustainable development policy.
Huh? And exactly how?
There's a lot of different factions involved. These guys are very powerful. They control the oil. We're talking about, you know, Dutch Shell and Standard Oil and BP and all these guys, very powerful people, and they've got a lot of front companies, and they create these companies, and then they use them as kind of pawns to take the people wherever they want to go.
Right. No, I hear what you're saying, but it helps to the detail. You know, the devil is in the details. You know, it's important.
He made the point in his documentation that Shell Oil gave $100 million towards the man-made global warming issue. Now,
really?
Wait,
what do you mean they gave $100 million towards, like, in exactly how, to who? I mean, again, the devil is in the details. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's not making a lot of sense to me.
through various organizations. I mean,
but which organizations? If you're not going to say, you'd be able to say which organizations. I'm not going to be able to believe anything you're saying.
I can't remember.
Well, and come on.
I can't remember all the details. Yeah. I can't remember all the details.
Yeah, but I mean, the devil is in the details. Your scenario only makes sense if you actually can specify what exactly you're saying. Because so you're saying that human-made global warming doesn't exist. Is that what you're saying?
No, that is not what I'm saying. That is not what I'm saying. See, this is also another thing. Is these people have such control of the minds of the American people through the media and the government and all that sort of thing that we cannot talk to one another.
Right. Well, I just don't really understand what you're saying.
So I know you don't understand
because
that.
you're not really saying it.
That's what the problem is.
Okay.
I am a classical liberal. I advocate for the restoration of the constitutional republic. I advocate for the sovereignty and the self-determination of the people.
All right, we're gonna have to move on here because
you're on a whole different plane than I am, and it's important that people like you and I have a conversation.
Yeah, but I'm asking you to say exactly what you're saying, and you're not able to say it.
I did say, I gave a specific place that you can go to see this documentary.
Oh, yeah.
It is called Why Big Oil Conquered the World.
Okay, here, hold on. Let me just say what I think about this is what Big Oil has actually done is actually funded the climate science denial. If you're saying they actually have funded the idea
they fund
that...
both sides. They fund both sides.
No. But there's evidence. But if you need to give me evidence, you need to give me evidence of where exactly that happened, because there is very definite documented evidence, specifically in Exxon.
He lays out the evidence in the documentary.
Okay, I'll watch it. Okay, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Well, that was interesting. So there we go. This is postmodernism in action. What is really true, and the difficulty of pinning down what is really true. And as James said, the difficulty of us actually talking to each other, because some people believe that things like that the oil companies are playing both sides, or promoting this idea that climate change is caused by the global warming that we see happening, the increase of carbon dioxide is caused by the fossil fuel, burning of fossil fuels. So James says that that's something that was promoted by the oil industry and the other side also, the denial of it. And so they're playing both sides against the middle and keeping us confused. What is the actual truth? Huh. That's a good question. All right. So 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. So, okay, here's an article called The Anthropocene and the End of Postmodernism by Edmund Berger from 2015. In his 1979 book, The Postmodern Condition, Jean-Francois Lyotard famously described the coming age of postmodernism as the dissolution of grand narratives, that is, overarching schemes or horizons of thought that unifies social forces. It's a typo there. It is possible, he wrote, that these narratives are already no longer the principal driving force behind interest in acquiring knowledge. From then on, postmodernism became a buzzword, bound up in a nebulous array of definition, counter-definition, debate, celebration, and disgust. It found its application rapidly in the worlds of art, literature, and architecture. Postmodern allowed the creator to step outside the conditions of progress and time itself, blending effortlessly the old and the new, the highbrow and the lowbrow, the abstract with the concrete. The postmodern condition is name-checked endlessly. Yet something that seems to be repeatedly glossed over is the fact that the argument put forward by Lyotard is a discourse grounded in techno-scientific development, or more properly, an analysis of a new mode of organization emerging from within a new techno-economic paradigm, that of the rise of computing power and the regime of post-industrial capitalism that it empowered. This is clear from the book's opening paragraph. Quote, our working hypothesis is that the status of knowledge is altered as societies enter what is known as the post-industrial age and cultures enter what is known as the post-modern age. This transition has been underway since at least the end of the 1950s, which for Europe marks the completion of Reconstruction. The pace is faster or slower depending on the country, and within countries it varies according to the sector of activity. The general situation is one of temporal disjunction, which makes sketching an overview difficult. A portion of the description would necessarily be conjectural. At any rate, we know that it is unwise to put too much faith in futurology. And that's from Jean-Francois Lyotard. Okay, Mike's on the online, but hold on, let me just get another paragraph in here. By pointing to the 1950s as the moment in which postmodernism began its ascendancy, Lyotard is grounding his discourse in the development of the information theory and systems thinking, both interrelated products of World War II era scientific research. In the models advanced by these theories, the lines demarcating man and machine, and nature by extension, collapse into an array of feedback loops, distributed flows, and emergent patterns following shifts from equilibria to disequilibria and back again. From one perspective, these developments point towards the possibilities of new ethical formations. Such was the work, for example, of Gregory Bateson, among others. Yet the sciences were born in the whole of the so-called military-industrial complex, and it was to the twin powers of war and industry that they have largely remained coupled. Just look at the rise of the internet, I add. In elliptical fashion, Lyotard acknowledges this historical composition, coupling society to post-industrialization and cultural to postmodernism. He argues that the decline of narrative can be seen as an effect of the blossoming of techniques since the Second World War, which has shifted the emphasis from ends of actions to its means. It can also be seen as an effect of the redeployment of advanced liberal capitalism after its retreat under the protection of Keynesianism. And this harks back to my point about the crisis of the Great Depression and, you know, the rise of Keynesian deficit spending to fund the welfare state, which I believe is what's encapsulated in that phrase there by Lyotard. Neither of these trajectories, in fact, is capable of being separated from one another. As the history traced in Philip Murawski's difficult yet essential Machine Dreams, Economics Becomes a Cyborg Science, illustrates, the theories that became neoliberal capitalism were themselves honed in the military's think tanks alongside research into cybernetics, game theory, operations research, and systems analysis, as well as the correlated evolutions in computer technology necessitated by the war effort and the demands of the rising Cold War. These trajectories broke open into the international stage in 1972 when the crisis of the dollar's imminent devaluation led President Nixon, under the advice of Chicago School economist Milton Friedman, to remove the U.S. currency from its gold standard, thereby undermining the worldwide monetary order and demolishing the international regulatory scheme arranged by the post-war Bretton Woods institutions. The result was the dizzying explosion of finance markets. Without gold, global interest rates were no longer fixed and became instead free-floating and flexible. Computerized marketplaces proliferated, opening spaces where futures contracts could be traded across a variety of international currencies. The rise of finance economies around these trading hubs played directly into the evaporating of industrial bases of the dominant world economies, and aided by dynamic modelizations and enhanced communication techniques made possible by possible information technologies. All right, we got a whole bunch of people ready to talk, so I'm going to end there. But let's see, Mike, Harvey, and Lee, and we'll go to Mike in a second. That's The Anthropocene and the End of Postmodernism, an excellent article. So, Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Paul. Great show. Glad you're talking about this topic. I was in architecture school in the 80s, and our instructors were, you know, the progressives from the 60s, and we had the difference between the rationalists and the upcoming postmodernists, where, you know, part of the camp was looking at new technology, energy efficiency, solar, that type of thing. And then the rationalists, well, or the postmodernists, you can see here in Portland, where the Portland building that Michael Graves did in the 80s, you know, sort of was the height of postmodernism, where more like cartoon architecture. And the remnants of that can still be seen, where when you talk about environmental concerns, life cycle costs, energy efficiencies, are still looked upon as radical, or, you know, again, with the petrochemical industries looking at that part of it. So it's almost like where Reagan, you could think, would be more the first postmodern president, where he took down the solar panels that Carter put up. And even today, we use terms like, you know, the four corners of the globe, sunrise, sunset. It's a mindset that's, you know, anti-rational, anti-science, that it's almost like a fear of the future, as I can see it.
Okay.
So I just want to thank you for your time and the show, and keep up the great work.
All right. Well, thank you for calling.
Sure thing.
Let's go right to our next caller. Harvey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, I'd like to take a step forward by taking a step backward. And we live in the age of plastic, and so much so that it's poisoning us and our planet. For example, our oceans are overloaded with plastic. China won't take our plastic waste anymore. And I'd like to see a movement called Back to Glass. You know, here in California, we have Proposition 65 that tells us that the chemicals known to the state to cause cancer and birth defects and other reproductive harm are found in petroleum and their byproducts. And most plastic is made out of petroleum. And so we throw away all these plastic cups and straws. I mean, it's endless, everything that we throw away. And it and it just degrades. It goes into the ocean. The sunlight breaks it down. The fish eat the plastic. And then we eat the fish. And we know plastic and its byproducts create cancer. So it may be the key to our cancer problem and birth defect problem. And I would like to see us go back to renewable glass that's recyclable.
So you're not even going to try to tie this into the discussion of postmodernism, are you?
Well, I feel that we're in the postmodern stage, but I think we have to look at it and possibly take a step backward to ensure our health as we go forward.
Right. No, I agree. But these things, when people talk the way you're talking, which I agree with what you're saying.
Thank you.
But the problem is always, well, so how are we going to get there? And so the discussion of postmodernism gets into these really nitty gritty issues of how we look, you know, how we understand society, how we look at power. And these are issues we haven't gotten that much discussion on today. But so, you know, it begs what you're saying basically begs the question of how do we develop the, you know, whatever it takes to overturn the plastic industrial complex, which
is
basically
one way I think is that the glass associations for bottling containers of glasses should promote a back to glass concept with, for instance, a simple term: plastic equals cancer.
Right, but they should is, you know, when saying people should do something still begs the question of who's going to get it done. So I totally applaud what you're saying, and I think the, you know, the idea that the illusion that plastics were really a very much of a, you know, that were really that recyclable in any case was just basically bought us all into the idea that we can have our cake and eat it too, that we can live in a defiled, you know, petrochemical dominated world and still, you know, survive. And I think that illusion is being shattered, and ironically, by, you know, China, the, you know, our arch world competitor here economically, is, you know, now saying that our plastics aren't clean enough for them. So it's forcing us back to perhaps a reality. So anyway, thank you for calling. I appreciate your points.
Thank you, Paul.
Let's go right to Lee, I believe.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Paul. What I don't understand is, if we're going to defeat one European-centered thought process, that specifically being capitalism, you know, why are we trying to deal with, you know, something like Marxism, with it, which is, you know, another Eurocentric thought process? Because in that dialectic, you know, the synthesis is not going to be anything but European-centered thinking. And my proposition, my attitude greatly changed when I read Vindaloria's God is Red. And I would like to read his final paragraph in that book.
Go ahead.
Who will find peace with this land? The future of mankind lies waiting for those who will come to understand their lives and to take up their responsibilities of all living things. Who will listen to the trees, the animals, the birds, the voices of the places of the land, as the long-forgotten peoples of their respective continents rise and begin to reclaim their ancient heritage? They will discover the meaning of the lands of their ancestors. That is when the invaders of North American continent will finally discover that for this land, God is Red.
Yeah, no, I love that book, you know, as well as numerous other Vindaloria's books. Definitely highly recommended.
But that's not a Eurocentric form of thinking.
Right. Well, my initial response is, okay, I would agree with you. But the problem is, as European, you know, as personally a person of European descent, and as, you know, many of us listening, many of us in the United States, we still have to reckon with our own worldview. And do we do it? You know, can we become, you know, can we think indigenously? Can we become, it's a very difficult question. I think the, you know, if you read, say, Baudrillard, I think he was struggling with this really, and I think he's very misunderstood. He was struggling with this from within the challenge of anthropology, you know, pardon my little digression here, but he was very influenced by Marcel Mauss's The Gift, which itself was a very important anthropological, philosophical kind of touchstone, in that they were working off of some of the first generation of sort of anthropological field researchers who were living with studying these non-Western, non-European peoples who had radically different life ways, patterns of behavior, thought, cultural relationship. And, you know, a lot of people, like, say, Margaret Mead, took it as a direct challenge to our own, you know, took it back and reflected upon our own, you know, Western society. And there's a whole, you know, the 1940s, 50s, 60s was really ripe with that sort of critical self-reflection, and, you know, helped in some ways give rise to postmodernism. So let me finish this long discursus by saying that the challenge in Baudrillard's book, A Mirror of Production, was a direct challenge to what you're saying. He's basically doing what you're saying to Eurocentric thought, and trying to, you know, in a way, step outside that. But it's a very difficult process because we live within it. All our institutions are derived from that. So,
you know, why are we continuing on this process? Why do we continue to think that we need to be in control? Why don't we just plain stop after 500 years of idiocy and begin to listen to native peoples?
Well,
and let them make the decision.
Well, sure.
Why don't we
follow them? Sure, but there's a small minority of us who are really willing to do that. And there's still, even if you look at, say, the Standing Rock movement, you know, my monthly co-host, once a month co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who spent some time there and had a lot of connections there, was very critical of the way a lot of the you know, the environmental groups and other groups were and individuals were relating to that movement. There was a lot of co-optation. There's a lot of opportunism. So the same problems continue, even in the movements that we are trying our best, seemingly, to actually follow Native people. So the because problem they, the problem they, remains within our culture. It's a cultural problem, and we have to address that within our culture. We can't just step outside our culture, if you see what I'm saying.
That's the issue, is we have to, if we want to survive, if we want to survive as a species, if we want to have a biodiverse environment and a healthy planet, we have to step outside of it because it doesn't work any longer. European thinking has to
right. We have to both step outside it and work through from within it. And I don't know how to say it much clearer than that, but it's a conundrum wrapped in a...
Who will speak for the trees? Who will speak for the other species? Who will speak for the sacred spaces? If it's not us, who?
I agree with you, but it's not as simple as that. So anyway, let's let...
Thanks.
Okay. Let's let, I believe we have a Kogi, if that's your name, on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Cody.
Cody.
You know, I like what you're talking about. It's a little heady for the regular person when you're talking about Freeman and his style and all that. So I'll try to, like, break it down a little bit to the layman's term in our modern day society. And let's get this straight. The capitalism that... The word capitalism that's used over the air and with the audience in general is one big fat lie. Crony capitalism is closer to a deeper truth. And we saw this crony capitalism with the bank bailout of 2008. All right? Now, that crony capitalism exists. We have this Western thought. And this Western thought, unfortunately, is the gold standard for the rest of the planet to follow. And as all of your callers have pointed out, it's not sustainable for the humans. We all know the planet will be here long after we've caused our own extinction. Fine. As far as the postmodernism thing, we've been stuck in time and space since 1945. And my prime example is the gas-driven combustible engine. All right? Now, I understand that we got, like these new cars with batteries and all that, but they pose a different risk also. I don't want to get into the batteries and the waste and all that other stuff.
But let me just stop you there for a second. I don't understand what you said. Capitalism is a lie.
Well, because what's closer to the truth is crony capitalism.
But I don't
and
understand that.
That's why
that.
I brought up the bank bailout.
Yeah, but that's
according
not. I don't
capitalism,
understand.
These banks were supposed to go into extinction.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. That the idea you mean more like free. The idea of free market is a lie. Basically,
that's not free marketism.
Right,
it's
right.
Not free marketism is when you screw up in a free market
right.
And you go to your buddies specifically to get to to get taxpayers' money to bail you out of something that you did.
Right.
Once upon a time, when people made those screw-ups, they went broke because that's what capitalism is supposed
well, that's
to
a,
be.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think my feeling is more like that free market is sort of this propaganda developed by the capitalist system. So I think capitalism has been linked to the state and has been fostered by the state from the very get-go.
Without an unequivocal doubt, but unfortunately, the definition of capitalism can't even be lived up to by the people who created the term. I'm saying is there's nothing but hypocrisy in the system, and especially for the capitalists, okay?
Well, I'll go along with
that.
And
maybe that's pushing more towards corruption. I'll let you figure that one out. I'm not that clever.
I'm not sure I am either.
And let me point, as a result of this technology, we could have gone much further, but as a result of this crony capitalism, we have this thing called a copyright laws that are being held a little bit too long, and it's holding back any real innovation for this postmodern nation. Postmodern, how do you say that?
Postmodern.
okay, this postmodern technology to come into play to where we can run off of fully hydrogenated cars that run off of water and that could pull the hydrogen directly out of the water. It's not like we don't have the technology, but when you start using these type of technologies, you're talking about tectonic shifts, okay? We this thing is new. Humans have been around for millions of years, and all of a sudden, in these last 100 years...
No, we haven't been around for millions of years. Homo sapiens has only been around for...
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Tomatoes, tomato. But you know what I'm trying to say? These gadgetries with our industrial revolution has radically changed society, and it's changing our evolution as human beings.
Well,
and I'm saying is that if we're going to really tackle this stuff, this really heady conversation that you're having, we need to break this down to layman's, and we also need to expose the hypocrisy by the very people who have this propaganda like, oh, we have capitalism. No, this isn't Trading Places. Okay, and in Trading Places, at the end of the movie, Randolph Duke Mortimer Randolph and Duke Mortimer lost their butts and they became bums. In reality, however, their buddies on the Federal Reserve Bank bailed them out. That's not capitalism. All right.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're about out of time here. Thank you for calling and laying that out for us, Cody. Appreciate it. I've opened up as often happens when I go solo here, a huge can of worms. I'm not sure anybody's any clearer on what postmodernism actually means, but I would encourage you to go to these articles that I cited, and I will make a very good faith effort to go back to my program page and fill in with some of the titles here. We got another caller. Tim, you got just a minute. Go ahead.
Just a minute. Wow, now I feel under pressure. I think what the last caller was talking about was capitalism at the micro level versus capitalism at the macro level, right? Micro level would be like family-owned businesses, small scale, small to medium scale. That kind of capitalism, I think, is okay in general because it doesn't get out of control, and if it does get out of control, it can't do as much damage, right? Macro level, you have the gigantic corporations where wealth and power is concentrated. That's where, when corruption comes in or misguided goals comes in, maximum damage can be caused in society.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's a succinct summation. I appreciate that.
Take care, bro.
Okay, thank you for calling. And we've got to get out of here. Again, the Anthropocene and the End of the Postmodern, The Rise and Malaise of Postmodernism, Is Client Denialism Postmodern? Some of the titles we've been talking about today. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more programming here on KBOO Community Radio. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.